content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled The Sailboat and the Storm by David Woolman and Julian Smith. The untold story of the civilian fleet that patrolled American waters during World War II and the frantic search for the Zeta, a volunteer vessel lost in a ferocious nor'easter. It was the afternoon of December 3, 1942, and a vicious winter storm was thrashing boats along the eastern seaboard. U.S. Navy and Coast Guard listening stations were picking up urgent distress signals up and down the coast. A 71-foot schooner called the Nautilus, fighting 60-foot waves, had lost its sails to 50-knot winds. A sailboat called the Abenaki was completely adrift and at the mercy of the storm after its tiller was destroyed. The crew of a boat called the Tradition radioed a possible farewell. "This may be our last transmission." Sailboats had no business being out in such weather, but that calculus didn't apply to those serving in the coastal picket force. A motley assortment of privately owned vessels, from luxury schooners to battered fishing boats, that had been called into wartime service. Manned by hastily recruited citizen sailors, the picket force was tasked with patrolling American waters from Maine to Florida and along the West Coast. Its primary objective in the Atlantic, to spot and report German U-boats, which were wreaking havoc on Allied ships. In May alone, the Nazi submarine fleet sank 115 ships in the Western Atlantic. The mariners aboard vessels of the picket force could hardly take out enemy submarines. They carried little more than guns. They could, however, report U-boat positions, neutralizing the German vessels' essential advantage, stealth. But most of the American boats, designed for fishing or weekend cruises, were unequipped for winter conditions in the North Atlantic, let alone a storm witnesses later described as a combination blizzard and hurricane. Now, one of the smaller crafts in the civilian fleet was trapped in the tempest, a sleek 57-foot sailboat called the Zeta. The boat's 9-man crew struggled for hours as the storm battered the yacht, throwing it off its position near Martha's Vineyard. As the winds intensified, the men watched the mainmast bend feebly, with wave after wave drenching the ship's deck and flooding into the cabin. The crew, captained by Curtis Arnall, a 45-year-old professional actor, debated their options, none of them good. They could use the smaller storm sail to try to head west for land, but this would require sailing into the gale, and they had trouble enough just staying afloat. Or they could take down all the sails and try to ride out the tempest, keeping the Zeta under control as best they could for as long as possible. Any disagreement was settled by the sea. In an instant, the wind tore the rigging from the smaller mast, turning the yacht nearly on its side and into an incoming wave. The men below deck were thrown across the cabin, followed by a rush of water that hissed against the tiny onboard stove, filling the cramped space with smoke. The upheaval threw James Watson, a fisherman and seal hunter by trade, against a bunk, breaking at least two of his ribs. Joe Choate, a former banker and experienced weekend sailor, smashed headfirst into a handrail, opening a bloody gash down his forehead. A third crew member was also hit on the head. Moments later, the sailboat righted itself, but there was no time to assess injuries. The crew had to bail out the Zeta before it sank. For nearly 2 hours, they used pots and pans to empty water out of the cabin. Eventually, they were able to take stock of the situation. On top of the injuries and shredded sails, the Zeta had lost the smaller of its two masts, and its life raft had been swept away. The boat's generator was waterlogged and useless, and the ship-to-shore radio's batteries were drained from so many attempts to reach help. The crew was nevertheless able to make contact with a B-25 bomber sent to search for vessels despite the treacherous weather. Their message was delivered by blinking Morse code with the lamp. The boat had suffered extensive damage, and three men were injured. The bomber reported the Zeta's location, but no boats on the water could reach it. Other picket force vessels caught in the storm were either rescued or slowly made their way back into the harbor, not the Zeta. Over the next few days, almost a dozen Army bombers and 14 Canadian planes helped search for the yacht. Inbound ship convoys from Europe were told to keep an eye out. The search for the Zeta became one of the most extensive in Navy history. By December 8th, a Navy gunboat sent a discouraged update to Coast Guard headquarters. Considering all factors, it is our opinion chances y'all still afloat remote. The United States had been in war for less than a year when the Zeta set out on its mission, but the country was already badly losing the Battle of the Atlantic. German U-boats had been laying waste to American vessels along the eastern seaboard and into the Gulf of Mexico. Suddenly fighting a war on two oceans, the U.S. Navy simply didn't have the resources to patrol more than 2,000 miles of Atlantic coastline. Ships carrying fuel and weapons to support the war in Europe were easy targets for U-boats lurking offshore. Over the course of just 12 days, a single submarine known as U-507 sank 8 cargo vessels in the Gulf of Mexico. German submarine commanders called this period Ein glückliche Zeit, a happy time. Wreckage, oil, and human remains washed up on the beaches from South Florida to Long Island, New York, and horrified citizens watched from Atlantic City's boardwalk as German subs pursued and sank merchant ships in broad daylight. The psychological toll on the home front was so severe that the War Department suppressed the number of submarine-related sinkings in order to avoid a panic. U-boats even came close enough to shore to land sabotage teams on Long Island and the coast of Maine. Shutting down ship lights at night did little to protect Allied vessels, since German sub-captains could easily make out ship silhouettes created by bright lights on shore. That summer, the Germans sank 2 ships so close to Virginia Beach that the destroyed vessels were visible to beachgoers, a macabre contrast of peace and war, in the words of one Coast Guard veteran who was there. If the U-boat attacks continued, they could tip the scales of war. Civilian mariners clamored to get into the fight. Look what the British had pulled off at Dunkirk, they argued, with hundreds of civilian ships helped evacuate close to 340,000 Allied soldiers from France as German forces were closing in. In the past, the U.S. Navy had employed private boats and crews in both Civil War and World War I. American pilots with the Civil Air Patrol were already supporting border and coastal patrols. In February 1942, Alfred Stanford, Commodore of the Cruising Club of America, one of the country's leading amateur sailing groups, sent a proposal to the Navy to use non-military sailing vessels for anti-submarine patrols and rescue operations. Navy officials, however, were wary of putting civilians directly in harm's way. That opinion began to change in March as newspapers picked up the story of the Navy's refusal, sparking a public outcry. The Navy organized the new fleet, which it called the Coastal Picket Force, under the aegis of the Coast Guard Temporary Reserve. To this day, the fleet remains a little-known facet of America's wartime history. Nearly everyone has heard of Rosie the Riveter, not so much the Picket Force. The fleet welcomed almost any kind of seaworthy vessel. Sleek motor cruisers, weathered trawlers, cutters with mahogany cabins and wet bars. At the peak of the program, an estimated 2,000 boats were used, crewed by more than 5,000 sailors. They came from all walks of life, from college students to taxi drivers, from grizzled sword fishers to former congressmen. The Boston Globe reported on a patrol boat crew that consisted of a newspaper photographer, an artist, a salesman, a garage mechanic, and a butler. Many men had been rejected by the traditional armed forces because of their age, weight, or conditions such as color blindness or hearing impairments. The Coast Guard Temporary Reserve was less picky. Choate, the banker and the Zeta's second-in-command, wrote that all a man needed to pass the physical exam was a discernible heartbeat. Some enlistees were skilled blue water sailors, while others had never been to sea. One volunteer recalled stopping at the New York Public Library en route to his interview for a crash course in nautical terms like port, starboard, and helm. He emerged from the interview as a seaman first class. Even celebrities joined the effort. Ernest Hemingway patrolled off the coast of Florida in his beloved cabin cruiser, the Pillar, and Humphrey Bogart offered up his yacht, the Santana, sailing out of Newport Beach, California. The sailboats in the force ranged from day cruisers to 150-foot racing yachts. As spotting vessels, they had several advantages over motorized craft. They weren't limited by fuel reserves, and because they were silent, they were harder for U-boats to detect, so they could get closer and report enemy positions more accurately using binoculars and eventually underwater microphones. Submarines had to surface periodically to refresh their air and recharge their batteries. Based out of the smaller home ports such as Greenport on Long Island, the Picket Force Flotilla was known informally as the Corsair Fleet, or sometimes the Hooligan Navy, an unsubtle nod to the ragtag collection of mariners at its core. Regular enlisted sailors looked at the mariners and this ersatz armada with suspicion, even derision, for their supposed lack of discipline and skill. The Walt Disney-designed insignia, Donald Duck as a pirate, complete with eye patch, dagger, and pistols, didn't exactly engender confidence. But nobody could deny the men's enthusiasm and gumption, and members of the Hooligan Navy came to embrace the nickname with pride. Aboard the Zeta, the crew took their orders from Arnall. Originally from Cheyenne, Wyoming, Arnall had worked as a ranch hand before making his way to Broadway, where he played small roles until the great crash of 1929 shattered the theater industry. His next role was playing the radio voice of the swashbuckling space hero Buck Rogers. The gig brought Arnall a measure of fame and an ego to go with it. Arnall was one of several experienced sailors among the crew. There was 26-year-old Vance M. Smitty Smith, who swore so consistently that for years his daughter thought that the white birds that flew along the coast were called goddamn seagulls. Edward Jobson, a sophomore at Williams College and at 20, the youngest crew member, had worked as a sailor on the Zeta before the war. A friendly young Finnish-American named Toivo George Koskinen was esteemed by the others for his sailing skills. The crew also included a taxi driver from Brooklyn, a Dartmouth College student, and a wiry fisherman and seal hunter with endless stories of peril at sea. The Zeta itself had been designed by a renowned shipbuilder and launched in 1937. Constructed with teak decking, mahogany woodwork, and masts made of Sitka spruce, the boat was a thoroughbred under sail, sleek, responsive, and above all, fast. After it was handed over to the Coast Guard Reserve, its fine trim and body were painted gray, and its official wartime designation, CGR-3070, was stenciled on the hull in large white characters. On November 27, 1942, the Zeta sailed to its assigned station, a 50-square-mile patch of ocean some 50 miles offshore. Its orders for the 7-day patrol: search for enemy subs around the clock, no matter the weather, and be ready to help with rescue operations if Allied ships were torpedoed. If the crew spotted a U-boat, they were to report their position on the ship-to-shore radio so that Navy boats or planes could take decisive action. Because the sailboats were slower than motorboats, often alone and barely armed, the Nazis didn't view them as worthy targets, especially since the attack would betray their location. Nevertheless, there were occasional confrontations. Off the coast of Maine, the Sally II and a U-boat watched each other warily, just out of gun range, for upwards of 15 minutes. Over a loudspeaker, the German captain finally ordered the American boat not to report its position. The crew did anyway. Luckily, the two vessels parted without incident. They were looking for bigger game, one crew member said later. Other stories recounted German subs surfacing directly under picket force vessels to the surprise of both crews. Then there was the Nazi commander who reportedly berated a crew of Hooligan soldiers directly, telling them to go home and stop playing soldier. But daily life aboard Hooligan vessels tended to be more tedious than thrilling. The Zeta's crew manned four-hour rotating shifts on watch, during which they would sometimes mistake whales or porpoises for surfacing U-boats. They fished for sharks with homemade hooks, radio position updates to their patrol boats and Coast Guard stations, and kept an eye out for storm petrels, tiny birds that sailors say heralded bad weather. Well, the ships were equipped with potbelly stoves, and each man was given a heavy fleece-lined coat and gloves. These resources were little match for December weather far out at sea. Most of the time, the men just tried to keep warm and waited for the next meal after a frigid shift on deck. After the Zeta was slammed onto its side, the storm was still raging. The crew discovered the vessel was badly damaged, and several men were injured. Watson was the worst off. To protect him, the men tied him to his bunk so he wouldn't be tossed around by the churning seas. Within hours, however, hope sailed into view in the form of the HMCS Caldwell, a Canadian destroyer that pulled close enough to identify the stricken sailboat. The Canadian crew tried to attach a tow, but the waves made it impossible to get a line aboard to the sailboat. To try to calm the surface, the Caldwell dumped heavy black bunker oil into the water, but this did little except cover the Zeta and its crew in thick, stinking grease. Finally, after a half a dozen or so tries, the Zeta crew retrieved a tow line. Koskinen was on deck, making sure the line stuck, when he was swept into the icy water. He managed to grab a lifeline and haul himself back on board. With the tow line now attached, the men braced themselves as the slack ran out and the Zeta jolted forward. The yacht began picking up speed, its hull smashing against the water. It was a precarious ride, but it appeared the crew would be saved. But after some 7 hours of towing, the rope suddenly snapped. It was now just before midnight, and the boats were separated in the darkness. Without a working radio, there was nothing the crew of the Zeta could do. They were alone, helpless in the freezing rain and blinding winds. Over the next few days, the Zeta's crew fended off desperation with improvisation. They combined gasoline and motor oil to make a substitute for kerosene to power the cabin lamp. They fashioned a funnel out of sail canvas so they could capture rainwater to drink. At a lull in the storm, the crew got to work patching torn sails and sewing on metal slides so they could be reattached to the remaining mast. The one small makeshift sail they did have didn't provide much power, but it gave the crew enough control that they could start sailing, gingerly, but at least purposefully, to the southwest toward land. Meanwhile, Smith and Koskinen were determined to get the radio working again. So they began to filter seawater out of the gasoline to try to restart the generator. By the morning of December 9th, Arnall was able to transmit a brief message, which was picked up by Coast Guard Station on the mainland. Condition favorable, 3 men injured. Hearing this, the men were not just baffled, some were furious. Smith was beside himself. What part of being injured and adrift was quote-unquote favorable? Did the skipper think this was a Buck Rogers episode, where the unflappable hero always pulls through in the end? The crew already had their doubts about their commander, who had been described by another Greenport-based mariner as a quote-unquote foul ball. While out sailing just before the Zeta's first official patrol, Arnold had tried to cut a corner around a channel buoy and ended up running the boat aground. And the skipper was proving to be strangely possessive, almost secretive about things like radio reports, incoming message, and navigational details, going so far as to keep everything jotted on a notebook in his pocket. These episodes were concerning enough that after the Zeta's first few outings, several sailors had requested to be transferred to other boats. Now, according to one account, Smith began pacing around the cabin, muttering, "That man, that man." By the next morning, the Zeta had been at sea for 2 weeks in the heart of winter. The men slept only intermittently and ate dwindling rations of beans, rice, and canned peaches. They had resorted to tearing out cabinets and other non-critical parts of the cabin to burn in the stove to stay warm. The cumulative stress and calorie shortage was taking their toll. At one point, Arnall ordered Koskinen to go aloft to affix the repaired sail into place. Koskinen responded that it couldn't be done. He was too exhausted. When Arnall pressed, Koskinen got halfway up the mast before stopping and retreating back down to the deck. "Too weak," he said. 3 days later, hope returned. Zeta was riding 40-foot waves about 300 miles east of Norfolk, Virginia, when the crew spotted a small Allied warship less than a mile away, heading straight for them. A large destroyer appeared next. It's a miracle that Zeta wasn't immediately blown out of the water. The destroyer initially mistook the wounded sailboat for a U-boat and sounded battle stations before realizing it was the lost picket force yacht. The nine men rejoiced, but once again their relief was premature. The seas were too heavy for the much larger ships to get close enough to take the men without smashing the sailboat. Moreover, it turned out the ships, escorting a convoy of freighters and tankers to support Allied campaigns in North Africa, were heading in the opposite direction, so towing was out of the question. And because the convoy had to maintain radio silence, the captain of the destroyer couldn't tell anyone. He had found the boat that the whole world seemed to be looking for, but he couldn't do anything to help. For the next few hours, the wind pushed the sailboat like a child's toy between two lines of convoy ships. At times, the vessels were close enough that the crews could see each other's faces, but all they could do was wave. The last Morse-coded message from the destroyer was simply, "Good luck." Then the convoy faded into the fog. Once again, the Zeta was alone in the Atlantic, driven out to sea by storm after storm. The days and nights started to blur. Theodore Carlson, the taxi driver from Brooklyn, comforted himself by reading the Bible. The crew daydreamed about steakhouses in Manhattan as their rations shrank to a single cup of whatever was left per day. Their faces grew gaunt and their bodies weakened. Jobson, the college sophomore, fainted on deck, and Ward Weimer, the Dartmouth student, became too feeble to handle the wheel. Tensions aboard the yacht edged toward a breaking point. One afternoon, after Arnall and Smith had argued over their latest point of friction, Arnall sat down in the cabin and took out his .38 caliber pistol, which he began cleaning in silence. When Smith stepped below deck and saw that Arnall was doing, he proceeded to take out his own gun, a .45, and started cleaning it as well. Nobody said a word, and the incident passed. Aware of his own short temper and afraid of doing something regrettable, Smith later asked Choate to hide his gun and never tell him where it was. Smith was on watch the night of December 22nd when he glimpsed a flash of color through the gloom, a red buoy and the first sight of land in almost a month. Suddenly, the dark shape of a Coast Guard patrol boat loomed barely 100 feet away. The men yelled and waved a flashlight, but the other vessel didn't respond or change course. In desperation, Smith took out the Zeta's automatic rifle and fired half a dozen tracer bullets over the other ship's bow. Unsurprisingly, the crew of the patrol boat thought they were under fire from a German submarine. They were maneuvering into attack position, guns ready, when they heard shouts in English. The ship drew close enough to identify each other. The Zeta's crew finally learned where they were, off Cape Hatteras in North Carolina's Outer Banks, and on the edge of a minefield. In geographic terms, the Zeta was essentially home. But because of the minefield, the boat was in more danger than ever. The Navy ordered the crew to stay put. The next morning, under windless skies, the Zeta's crew members, desperate to reach land and close to starvation, debated running the boat up on the beach, minefield or not. A silent tension hung in the air. Then a blimp appeared, and their excitement spilled forth in hugs, shouts, and laughter. Gathered on deck, the crew members waved and shouted with excitement. The blimp reported back to base, 6 men observed on deck, all gesturing wildly for food, and lowered a package of emergency supplies on a line. When the crew brought it on board, they found raisins, chocolate bars, and a note. "Your position reported, sit tight, help on way." Within an hour, 9 rescue planes had appeared. Coast Guard patrol boat pulled alongside, and the Zeta's crew climbed aboard, where pots of beef stew were waiting in the galley. And a heavy fog rolled in, forcing the crew to spend one last night on the water until conditions improved enough to tow the Zeta through the minefield and back to shore. They landed at the hamlet of Ocracoke, North Carolina, on the morning of December 24th. Hundreds of people lined the dock and nearby roads to welcome them. The bedraggled crew quickly boarded a plane to a naval air station in Brooklyn, where the family members were waiting, including Smith's pregnant wife. Some had been grieving their loved ones, convinced they had been lost at sea. Others had clung stubbornly to hope. The men who stepped off the plane were sun-browned, skinny, and traumatized from their month-long, nearly 3,000-mile saga. The mood at the reunion was not festive. There was no shouting or laughing. Just handshakes, quiet embraces, and a hurried effort by the military to get everybody home in time for Christmas. During the following year, the Navy built more capable patrol vessels, and German submarines shifted their attention to operations farther from America's shores. U-boat captains learned they could no longer attack with impunity up and down the eastern seaboard. As the threat from submarines decreased, the coastal picket force was reduced by two-thirds, and it was discontinued at the end of the war. Miraculously, only one member of the Hooligan Navy was killed while serving during a collision with a Dutch freighter. In a letter to Greenport Picket Force's commanding officer, a Navy official applauded the civilian soldiers' quote, superb brand of seamanship. I will not go so far as to say our pickets go hunting for gales, but when the gales do come along, these sturdy little boats just take the storms as a matter of course and ride them out, end quote. Newspaper accounts praise the Hooligan Navy as, quote, iron men and wooden ships, end quote. But most Americans were understandably focused on the wars being fought in Europe and the Pacific. The fleet's military impact on the Battle of the Atlantic remains an open question. There are no accounts of U-boats sunk directly because of a patrol boat sighting. But Robert Desch, a Coast Guard historian, says the Germans were forced to change their tactics after the picket force became operational. The presence of so many small craft limited the Germans' ability to hunt, while reassuring merchant seamen that if they were targeted, American craft would be there to scoop them out of the water. It certainly had an influence on what the Germans were doing, he says. John Wilbur, an independent researcher who has studied the coastal picket force for decades, offers a comparison with American submarine activity in the waters off Japan a few years later. The American subs were wary of small coastal craft, he says. Perhaps they were not the perfect answer, but sailboats were the best solution available in 1942 and 1943. Despite everything the Zeta's crew went through, most served through the end of the war. Some continued to sail for the rest of their lives. Arnall went on two commercial fishing vessels. Whenever he had a chance, he would tell anyone, neighborhood kids in Long Island, family friends, strangers in bars, about the Zeta and the harrowing tale of wartime survival. Choate ran the National Boat Show in New York for 20 years. Jobson became a publishing executive and continued to sail, cruising and racing along the East Coast aboard his own boat, the Stormsvala, a Swedish name for a kind of storm petrel. The wartime experience also seemed to strengthen Weimar's love of sailing. It didn't shake him enough for him to get off the ocean, his son Charles recently recalled. The rest of his life, Weimar seemed to have a special connection to the ocean and rough waters in particular. He settled in Bright Waters, New York, just off the Great South Bay, and whenever a storm rolled in, he would sit and stare out to sea. The Zeta is still berthed in Greenport, where its owner takes it out every summer. The gray paint is gone, but its owner keeps the Coast Guard reserve number painted on the hull, and the boat has most of its original fittings. At 88, it is one of the few Hooligan vessels still sailing. During a recent overhaul, a rusty rifle bullet was found lodged in the ceiling, most likely trapped there when the boat was knocked over during the 1942 storm. It's now in a frame on the cabin wall, a reminder of the yacht's wartime service and astonishing ordeal. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.